This is Junk Food Soda.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Thaw out, Junk Yawns. It's time for another futuristic episode of Junk Food Cinema right here on FilmScoreRejects.com. Taco Bell. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and I'm joined, as per usual, by my friend and co-host. He's a novelist. He's a screenwriter. He is a lieutenant of Megaforce. He is a maniac, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi.
How's it going?
It's going well.
Are you experiencing joy feelings?
I am feeling much joy feelings because, as many of you know, I have a book out. I have a book, Sea of Rust, that hopefully all of you have rushed out to buy. And if you haven't, please do so.
Please. I thought you were just going to end it with please.
Please.
Do so immediately. Yes, definitely pick up Cargill's book. Definitely do things like follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And if you really like the show, if you find it gives you all the joy feelings, you can contribute at patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. For as little as a dollar an episode, you get access to bonus content that no one else gets to hear, both now and in the distant future, where everyone wears robes and just there's no violence, and our recordings will last past into the rise of Edgar Friendly. That's all I'm going to say. So definitely patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. And oh my God, Cargill.
Brian Salisbury, you are fined one credit for the violation of the Verbal Morality Act.
Well, it's better than using the three seashells. I am so excited.
You are. By the way, before the end of the episode, I will explain the three seashells.
I hope you don't, because it's gross.
I found someone online who explained how the three seashells work.
Okay, I want to hear that explanation, and then I want to give you Stallone's explanation, which is fucking disgusting.
And it might be Stallone.
It might be Stallone. So we are talking this week about, we had an accidental, kismet, because last week.
Which always happens. Hey, we accidentally came up with these two things that just happened to be the work together. And they always are accidents. It's like, oh shit, that's right. We did pick two movies from the same year, 1993.
We did. And not only that, but there's a weird Sting connection in both last week's Three Musketeers and this week's Demolition Man.
At the end of a century, ravaged by violence, a society of perfect order will arise. Criminals will be frozen and reprogrammed in cryogenic prisons.
The prisoners are ice cubes. Their criminal instincts are being reprogrammed as they sleep.
Aggression and deviant behavior will be totally eliminated.
In a bad time, he was the worst.
I'm gonna love running this place.
But in the year 2032...
This morning, Simon Phoenix escaped from this cryo facility. We are, quite frankly, not equipped to deal with the situation.
Amidst a world of peace and calm...
We're police officers. We're not trained for this kind of violence.
How was the fiendish Simon Phoenix apprehended back in the 20th?
In the end, it took just one man. John Spartan.
You mean the Demolition Man?
Oh, hell.
Sylvester Stallone. Wesley Snipes. Demolition Man.
Oh my God, I'm so excited to talk about this.
Brian Salisbury, you are fined one credit for violation of the Verbal Morality Act.
Damn it.
I feel like we should torture Meryl this week.
Oh,
and every
Meryl.
Time we swear, he has to play the in the background.
By the way, I don't think I've mentioned this publicly yet or on an episode, but Meryl Barr is our editor now. And I'm so happy to have him because I might get to sleep every once in a while, which would be crazy.
We don't do a hell of a lot of editing, but
I do.
don't do a hell of a lot of editing.
I do way too much editing, which is why I had to bring Meryl on, because I fucking labor over those fucking episodes every week. And I will not make Meryl do it every time, because he'd be up all night. We swear a lot. But Meryl, if you could, every once in a while, every time we drop an F-bomb, just put in that fucking soundbite.
You are fined 1 credit for a violation of the verbal morality statute.
Thank you. But yeah, this is one of my favorite movies of the 90s. Like, it has risen to a point where this is one of my go-to films. This is when people ask me, what do you mean by junk food cinema? What does he talk about on your podcast? How is it different from other shows? I'm like, Demolition Man. That is a movie we're going to talk about lovingly.
Yeah, we will. And it's such a weird fucking movie.
It is.
Meryl.
You are fined 1 credit for a violation of the verbal morality statute.
It is. No, it really is. Like, it's a movie that was weird when it came out. Like, it was, it is a movie that, so let me play Old Man Cargill for a second.
Old Man Cargill. He just keeps talking a lot.
This was a movie that was very against the grain for its time. While it's very easy to look at and go, oh, well, this is clearly a big budget blockbuster movie, it did a lot of stuff with science fiction that no one was doing at the time. This is 1993. This is right at the tail end of the cyberpunk explosion. Like, cyberpunk was fucking cool as shit. Dystopian cinema and literature had dove headfirst into this idea and stayed there for a while that shit was going to get bad. We weren't so much feeling that we were going to go into an atomic wasteland as we had felt in the late 70s and early 80s. And it was more this terrible fear that Japan and their growing economic power was going to conquer the world, that we were going to become a second world country as a result, subjugated by Japan, that things like cybernetics and computers were going to so dominate our life in a way. Some of this literature, like the book Neuromancer, gave us the lexicon that we still use today. Things like World Wide Web and viruses and not viruses in particular, the net and things like this. Words that we use every fucking day came out of this fucking book.
The William Gibson future.
And there were a bunch of people writing about that at the time. And this zagged while everyone else was zigging. This was, no, what if we had a utopian future, but that utopian future was Sylvester Stallone's utopian nightmare?
Yeah.
And what's fascinating about the future that's created, and the ultimate theme of this movie, is that this future is literally the worst fears of what would happen if somebody who is very conservative and very liberal took over. Like, it's all the worst parts of 80s and 90s liberalism and 80s and 90s conservatism. This whole idea that we become so puritanical that we do not have sex anymore, that we do not swear, that we do not watch violent, you know, we do not consume violent content, that the best music out there, the most popular music out there, is jingles written, you know, in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, that this is such a puritanical 50s like idyllic world mixed with electric cars and technology that keeps us safe, but by keeping us safe also prevents free thought and also does this, but not in a way like in 1984. It's not Orwellian in how it's done. Instead, it's more along the lines of Brave New World. Like, it's,
yeah, Brave New World.
It's more like, hey, we're going to offer you this great world and you're going to embrace it. You're not going to be afraid of it. You're going to embrace it because this is the way to live life. And this entire movie is Sylvester Stallone playing John Spartan.
And I want you to I'm sorry.
A.K.A. Cobretti.
Cobretti, okay.
He's fucking so, Cobretti.
Because when you were talking, I was like, this is the future that Marion Cobretti has nightmares about.
Yes, and that's what this movie is.
Yeah.
This movie is the dystopian nightmare of Marion Cobretti. Like, this is the wet dream of Marion Cobretti, that Marion Cobretti is sent into the future to destroy this utopia so that we can finally get back to what's important, pizza cut with scissors.
Yes, and the thing is, this movie, I mean, you could boil it down reductively to Marion Cobretti is frozen in the past, wakes up in the future, and fights Dennis Rodman and film.
Okay, this is also Old Man Cargill. This is the other things I want to go into. First of all, this movie came out right before Dennis Rodman hit.
Oh, no, I know. Yeah, no, no.
I was living in San Antonio at the time. So he showed up as a player for the San Antonio Spurs and dyed his hair. And everyone nicknamed him Demolition Man as a result. That was his nickname while he was in San Antonio, was he was the Demolition Man. And I ran into him a bunch of times. He used to come and play video games at the same arcade I would play at. In fact, the week after he got into his motorcycle accident, he was playing a motorcycle game there, and I joined him, and I'm like, holy shit, I'm playing a motorcycle game with fucking Dennis Rodman the week after he got into his fucking motorcycle accident. This is stupid.
Now, was that video game called Gary Busey's Cross Country Adventure?
Oh!
I'm just asking questions.
I forget which one it was. It was whatever one of the popular ones. It's the one where actually mount the motorcycles.
Is that Road Rash?
No, it's I forget which one it was, but it was one of those where you actually like move the motorcycle to move. That's
where you're
actually sitting on the motorcycle. That's what was so crazy about it, was I'm on fake motorcycles with Dennis fucking Rodman in 1993 with his hair done up and he's Demolition Man.
Like, now this that's Cargill's utopia that he dreamed about as a small child
in fucking Diversions Arcade. Fucking it was crazy times.
You really licked his ass.
But here's the other thing that's important, was in 1993, Stallone's star was waning. He was not the big draw that he was anymore. He was not exciting fans anymore. It was, you know, he and Schwarzenegger were getting older and not evolving at this point. And so the weird big draw for this movie, for a bunch of fans to go see this movie, was this movie starred the greatest comedian to ever live in 1993, Dennis Leary. He was like, when we went in to see this movie, we're like, dude, he better do the rant. He better do his shtick. Like, this is why we're in this movie. And sure enough, we get a full-on Dennis Leary shtick.
I like to read. I'm into freedom of speech and freedom of choice. I'm the kind of guy who likes to sit in a greasy spoon and wonder, gee, should I have the T-bone steak or the jumbo rack of barbecue ribs with the side order of gravy fries? I want high cholesterol. I want to eat bacon and butter and buckets of cheese, okay? I want to smoke a Cuban cigar the size of Cincinnati in a non-smoking section. I want to run through the streets naked with green jello all over my body reading Playboy magazine. Why? Because I suddenly might feel the need to, okay, pal? I've seen the future. You know what it is? It's a 47-year-old virgin sitting around in his beige pajamas drinking a banana broccoli shake singing I'm an Oscar Mayer wiener.
Now, what you have to also keep in mind about 1993 is that Bill Hicks was not a huge hit yet. He was still this cult guy that comedians loved but turned off audiences.
Yeah.
He had not yet recorded his, because when Bill Hicks got sick, he recorded his three greatest albums all in the last 6 months of his life. So, you know, we would not be experiencing full-on Bill Hicks until 95 on. Like, it was the mid to late 90s that Bill Hicks really kind of took over the subculture. And at this time, nobody had realized that Dennis Leary had stolen his shtick from Bill Hicks. Like, that would become to be common parlance after the fact. Like, oh yeah, Dennis Leary was just a more mainstream reaction to Bill Hicks.
Yeah.
To be fair, Dennis Leary was funny as fuck. You know, he had just put out No Cure for Cancer, and No Cure for Cancer was this big hit. We all had it on tape or CD. I wore that my cassette out working at a summer camp that summer, and I was working at a Catholic summer camp. And so my respite at night was I would tune out to on my headphones and listen to fucking No Cure for Cancer.
None of this surprises me. This is my not surprised face.
So, of course, going into see this movie, we're like, where's Dennis Leary? We were promised Dennis Leary. And finally, when we get enough Dennis Leary, he actually does a rant that is very much like his rant from Asshole.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about this before, the strange, like, I really like weird trends in movies, like things people don't usually pick up on. And one of them that is my favorite is the overacting extra, followed only slightly by comedians in movies who stop the movie to do their stand-up comedy. Because this is a great example that when Dennis Leary starts doing basically that, I want to eat burgers, I don't want to watch porn, and blah, 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 blah,
I want to read a Playboy magazine, yeah. And
it's just the song Asshole that he's doing, you know, again, as a bit. But there's also, like, in Trading Places, where Eddie Murphy is in the jail cell and basically doing stand-up comedy. And then, of course, there's
Airplane.
Airplane.
Airplane, where you've got the guy who's, like, not, who's in a completely different fucking movie.
Or Shady Tree. or Shady Tree, I think is his name in Diamonds Are Forever, but the old comedian in Skatetown, USA, who's standing by the concession. You know what? That's
doing his
one.
Old vaudeville act.
It's not. I was going to say it's Rudy Ray Moore in Dolomite. Now I think it's that guy in Skatetown, USA.
It is, and that's why they brought him in, and he does his bit, and that bit is fucking great.
Yeah.
It is such a weird movie of its time that was about very much, like, again, we've talked about this several times on the show, and longtime listeners will know, you know, the 80s were really weird because every year the crime stats were getting worse. We really had this sense that society was going into the shitter and that it was awful and that everything was going to be terrible. And in 1993, it had turned around, but it had not stabilized yet. We didn't realize that we were going to go into an entire decade in which gun violence would drop. In which, you know, crime would drop, that we thought we were headed into a future of super criminals, so much so that a few years later, there would be the super predators theory of people clinging on to this idea that society was still going into the shitter. And this movie's a reaction to that, that approaches sci-fi in a way that a lot of people ignore how society really works, is that no society ever really devolves into the shitter. It evolves in some way. It zigs instead of zags. It does its thing that saves itself. And in this movie, it is society gets so bad, they turn to this guy who paints a picture for what society is and can be. And that society is glorious until you go underground.
They turn to their own Cardinal Richelieu, again, connecting to last week. I want to go back for a second to something you said about at this point in Stallone's career. The 90s did not start off well for Monsieur Sylvester Stallone.
No.
We had Rocky V to kick the decade off. Then we had Oscar. Then we had...
Which I think is underrated.
It's fine. Then we had Stop or My Mom Will Shoot, which is one of the most ineptly drawn comedies I've ever seen.
Have you ever heard Schwarzenegger talk about Stop or My Mom Will Shoot?
No, but oh my God, how do I make that happen in my ears immediately?
Oh, I will tell you, this is the beauty of Stop or My Mom Will Shoot. Stallone read the script, or not Stallone, Schwarzenegger read the script because they wanted him to have it. He hated it, but he decided to troll Stallone. So he told his agents to let it leak that he was interested in doing the movie. So Stallone, saying, fuck this, if Arnold wants it, I'm fucking doing it, went in, snatched it up, and made Stop or My Mom Will Shoot.
Wow.
Because Arnold Schwarzenegger fucking trolled him.
Wow.
That is what fucking he fucking took the bait from Schwarzenegger, which is why one of them was governor and the other was not.
Which is why one of them was governor and one of them looks like he swallowed a whole bunch of monkey blood now.
And oddly enough, in this movie, it references what would come to pass in a conversation we would actually have. 10 years ago, we had a very real conversation about whether we should amend the Constitution to allow someone like Schwarzenegger, who has been a naturalized citizen for over two decades at this point, who is a governor, who is beloved, that maybe we should let him be president, that maybe that is an outdated thing that was written into the Constitution.
That maybe we picked the wrong host of The Apprentice to be the goddamn president. Just throwing that out there.
But that's referenced here with President Schwarzenegger. Again, a future that didn't happen, but a future that we actually had a conversation nationally about happening.
Yeah.
Which is very strange. Like, he knew, he was telling us back then about Arnold's ambitions. Like, he knew Arnold and knew that that was part of his ambitions. And that was, that's kind of amazing that that's in there.
Yeah, it is. And I want to give props to Stallone, because for as bad as the 90s started off for him, the return to goddamn form was 1993, in which we got not only Demolition Man, but also Cliffhanger. Because if you haven't seen Cliffhanger, it is one of my favorite Die Hard ripoffs of all time.
Why have we not done Cliffhanger yet?
Because we are only 3.5 years old as a podcast, and
we can only do so many Stallone films.
We can only do so. We have to. Like, I think at this point, Stallone is the actor we've probably covered the most. I think this podcast makes it official.
Bill Paxton.
It's neck and no neck with those two guys. Like,
I think we've covered Paxton far more.
It's possible.
I'm sure someone out there, I'm sure Hannibal Montana will be like, no, guys, actually, here's the person you've actually covered more than, and we'll be like, oh, shit,
we have. Santos has got his abacus out, and he's fucking
he
counting.
Does. He's we love you counting. Guys.
But we, you know what? We are roughly 20 minutes into this episode. We might want to describe the plot of Demolition Man.
Pass is over, John. Time for something new and improved.
Do we really need to?
I think we do. So this movie starts in 1996, so 3 years into its own future, apparently imagining that the middle of the Clinton administration would be the end times, because we open up and the Hollywood sign is on fire and the crime is so rampant. Like, this is the Marion Cobretti future right here.
Here's the weirdest thing is this movie feels like, especially in the opening, that it's ripping off Michael Bay a year before anybody saw Michael Bay movies.
Yeah, before anyone knew who Michael Bay was.
Like, Michael Bay took this and said, it goes to 11.
Yeah. If there was...
Like, can we fly over the Miami sign instead of the Hollywood side? Because that would really be...
Can we get a little more asshole guitar in this and maybe have a helicopter in slow motion instead of Stallone jumping out of it? But Stallone plays a cop named John Spartan, who's gotten the reputation and the nickname of the Demolition Man because of his tactics. He's the guy who will knock every building down to save someone or to take out a bad guy. And, you know, it's one of those, another great thing that we love about movies, a weird trend is when they say the name of the movie in the movie, and it's always like at a really funny point, like, I've had it, like the captain shows up, like, I've had enough of this Demolition Man shit. And it's like, oh, that's what it's called.
One of the great small moments of this movie is when Sandra Bullock is going back and watching an old video of him, and a reporter comes up and goes, you just destroyed a $7 million mini mall to save a girl who whose ransom was $45,000. And the little girl just goes, fuck you, lady.
I love that moment.
That moment's so good because that's how the audience feels. Like, at this point, in the 90s, in what we were dealing with, there was this big conservative swing of yes, we want our cops to be overbearing and take out the bad guys because we want to feel safe. The bad guys are so bad, we need good guys that are bad too. And Stallone played that for several years. And that's the interesting thing about this movie is that John Spartan is fucking Cobretti. Like, it is the exact same character pasted onto this. And
but it's that character played with meta, like, self-reference, whereas Cobra is a character, it's Stallone trying to just be gritty and dark and kind of, you know, in my mind, be a little bit more serious than he had been at the time. This is just full on like Stallone making fun of himself. And it's in that grand tradition of, in this period of time, action heroes getting meta movies. Every action hero you name has had a movie that's about that actor.
This is the second Stallone movie that we've covered that makes a Rambo reference.
It's true. Tango and Cash and Demolition Man both make Rambo references. And, you know, it's for Schwarzenegger, it was Last Action Hero. For Chuck Norris, it was Sidekicks. JCVD would have to wait a few more years for JCVD.
Kurt Russell in Escape from L.A.
It's Kurt Russell in Escape from L.A. They all got these movies that were more about the actor playing the character than it was about the character.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really interesting trend, and it leads into my theory that Bruce Willis has one too, and it's Unbreakable, where he finally John McClane wakes up one day and realizes the reason that he's never been killed by all these terrorists is that he's a superhero. And it's, in fact, his old friend Zeus who ends up being the one to tell him, by the way, you're a superhero. That's why you've survived, in order, a high-rise fire, a plane crash, and a train derailment, which is exactly what happens in the three Die Hard movies. Just saying.
Your tone is quasi-facetious, but you do not realize that Taco Bell was the only restaurant to survive the franchise wars.
So?
So? Now all restaurants are Taco Bell.
No way.
But so, John Spartan goes up against a villain whose name was basically dropped into a bad guy name generator online, Simon Phoenix, played by Wesley Snipes.
In which he, even though his last name is Phoenix, and we get Phoenix references, we even get a Simon Phoenix's rest from the ashes. He's really leaning on this Simon Says bit.
Yeah, it's like, dude, your last name is Phoenix. And you're way too invested in the Simon.
Yeah, you're in the Simon and not the Phoenix. Like, the thing is he plays with fire so much, you would think that would be his thing.
Right? But he's a real pyromaniac.
Yeah, but no, he's just...
Maniac, lie on the ground, or else.
I will say, my one quibble that I love about this movie, the thing that I embrace about it and yet is not good, is Wesley Snipes is in a completely different fucking movie than everybody else.
Wesley Snipes is the definition of unhinged.
Like, he is,
movie.
Yeah, he's like, he thinks he's playing the Joker. Yeah, he thinks he's playing the Joker and that he's having fun doing this in a way that doesn't totally make much sense.
He's playing the Joker as if Frank Gorshin's The Riddler is playing the Joker. Like, it's that level of just complete camp over the top.
And that's it's why I opened up the episode the way I did, is because when you break this movie down, this movie is not about John Spartan versus Simon Phoenix. This movie is about the future and just all the things that John Spartan, that Cobretti, his nightmare is, waking up in that nightmare and then bringing that nightmare down to its knees, like destroying that. Like, one guy could level an entire society is just absurd, but that's what this movie is. It's almost like, I almost want to go super meta with it.
Do it. Super meta for The Quest for Peace.
Yeah, let's meta this movie a bit. I'm going to say that this movie might, in a certain regard, be much like a previous Schwarzenegger film, a Schwarzenegger Verhoeven film called Total Recall, where really none of this movie happens, and it's all really just a nightmare that John Spartan is dealing with
in the cryo prison.
While he's having in cryo prison. Like, okay. this is his nightmare.
Can I ask a question? How in the blue hell? So what happens is Simon Phoenix takes hostages. John Spartan goes in there to try to rescue them. Simon Phoenix says, "I've already killed the hostages. Fuck you." The building blows up and, you know, Spartan pulls Phoenix out of it. And then it's revealed that the hostages were in the building. So they blame John Spartan, his recklessness for getting the hostages killed. And somehow that leads to John Spartan getting the same fucking cryo prison sentence as the guy who actually killed the hostages.
It's not the same sentence, actually.
Oh, you're right. You're right.
No. He only gets
5 years.
Yeah, but he gets 2 years for every person who died on the bus for involuntary manslaughter. And what it is at the beginning of the movie, they do really set up that he shouldn't be doing this. And they're like, "We shouldn't be here. Why are we here?
Who's one of the people that tells him he shouldn't be here? Speaking of Die Hard, Mr. Grand L. Bush, one of the two Johnson FBI guys from Die Hard, is again in a fucking helicopter.
Yep.
Next to a fiery building. Probably should get a new beat. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, well, he does in the movie.
Yes,
as old man exposition.
Yes, old man exposition. Yeah.
Stargrove.
No, actually, I love the actor Bill Cobbs, who he kind of grows up to be.
Oh, no, Bill Cobbs is one of those amazing character actors that just every time you see him, he is just, he just seems like a human hug of a human being. He always has exposition. You know what he has? He has the same thing as Anthony
Bourdain. No, I'm just kidding. See,
now you've derailed me.
That's what I do.
No, Hannibal Lecter.
Anthony Hopkins.
Anthony Hopkins, where you can give him a mouthful of gobbledygook, and he'll just say it in this folksy charm that is exposition that the audience goes, "Oh, I know what's going on now. I completely understand why the police force is different in this day and age." Like, that's Bill Cobb's magic. He's one of those guys who just anything that comes out of his mouth, you're like, "I believe that." And having him there as the old guy riding a desk still is so great. Yeah. And that scene when he and Stallone meet again for the first time is there's just this... Like, it's for the first time he's like, "Oh my God." In fact, here's the fucked up thing about the movie. Stallone never meets his daughter. We talk about his daughter. His wife is dead. We talk about his daughter. He doesn't want to meet her. His only connection to the old world is Bill Cobb. And in that moment, he feels at home again for the only time in the movie. And it's such a great small moment that they then go and add a little humor onto. which is very strange. Little sidebar, you know, in I forget what you call it, but in Tales of the Fiancé.
Oh, the unfiltered fiancé.
Unfiltered fiancé. Yes. Unfiltered wife. Unfiltered wife. My wife came in 2/3 through the movie, has never seen this movie. I did not discover until now. She had been out. I was rewatching it. She walks in and lays down on the bed with me, and Sandra Bullock is doing her Sandra Bullock bit in this. And she's like, is she supposed to be like this? Is she supposed to sound this way? Because she, this might be the worst Sandra Bullock has ever done. She's won an Academy Award. Like, she's great. Like, why is she? Why is she? And I'm like, everybody talks like this, and it's the future, honey.
No,
she's
see,
like,
the big one, the big quake that rocked the entire West Coast, the ground opened up, and Sandra Bullock's character landed smack dab on the spectrum.
You know, the thing is, I love that about this movie. This is another element I love about the movie, is that they're trying to relay to us how different people might sound in the future. Like, people who listen to, if we sent this podcast, if we put this podcast on audio cassette and sent it back to 1993,
can we do that?
People would be like, what are these words, podcast? You know, what is this word, DVD? Like, what is, you know, the various things that we've talked about, you know, wait, what is The Apprentice? And wait, Schwarzenegger was a governor? Like, what the fuck are you guys talking about? Yeah. That's ridiculous. Like, it, you know, especially when you consider this movie was made in 93 and you go back just 50 years and people in movies were talking in what was called intercontinental, which was this specific accent and the specific thing that they did in movies so that they could show movies in various territories. And it would all sound the same, you see, in ways that, you know, the language evolves. And so the way they evolve the language in this movie to be very stocky and be very upbeat and happy, and there are no negative words, and there are, you know, things like you mentioned, joy, you know, like, are you experiencing joy? The fact that, you know, you don't get killed, it's murder, death, kill.
It's a murder, death, kill.
Murder, death, kill.
You know, the way they...
Which is so stupid, murder, because you have all three of the words for what this is, so you haven't really changed the language so much as you just say all of the words at once. Like, well, I don't know. That was just really odd to me.
It is. But that's just the way language does weird shit sometimes.
And that being a true.
Yeah. I don't think that, I mean, they clearly didn't get the future right. I mean, this is definitely one of those movies like The Warriors, I'm blanking.
Hackers.
Hackers. That was the other one I was looking for. Yes. Where it's like, we are on the cutting edge of this thing and we're going to embrace this thing. And this is what the future will be like. And like certain things, like they showed, you know, in 2032, self-driving cars. But in 2032, our self-driving cars probably won't allow us to control them as well.
Because that's when the robots will rise up and Judgment Day will happen and Skynet will go live. Guys, it's coming. I'm just saying, face recognition on your phone. Fuck yourself.
We made a deal. We would not sell my book, Sea of Rust, available now in stores, except at the beginning and the end of the episode. Drop that Sea of Rust about a robot apocalypse.
I forgot that Sea of Rust was written by Miles Dyson.
That is correct.
Anywho, so what ends up happening is they're both cryo-frozen in the cryo-prisons, and then what happens is during a parole hearing, which, why are they still doing parole hearings if A, he's sentenced to life, and B, he's a block of ice. I don't understand the... Anyway, so they're doing, like, parole checkups, and Wesley...
Being sentenced to life, you can have parole, especially in California.
Okay, I get that now. This is the distant future.
No, here's the real question I have. In the movie, they mentioned we did away with the standard parole system years ago. And it's like, well, then why are we still having parole? Like, what was the point of that fucking line? Like, what?
Because Deus Ex Wesley Snipes is why. And then he ends up breaking out, and no one knows how to deal with him, how to deal with a guy who just kills people for fun and is really violent. All the police are basically, you know, hug counselors in the future. So, since
we're here, since we're asking questions about this thing, I have a question.
Hit me.
If our big bad boss of the movie has gone in and allowed a complete reprogramming of the system to train Simon Phoenix in all of these things instead of knitting and knitting. Instead of that, why didn't he just go into the computer and change the date that his changed the dates that he was supposed to get out of prison so that he could have just walked out of prison instead of having to fight his way out.
Because movies.
Because movies. Yes. No, that is my point. It's that if there's any plot hole in this movie that, you know, I would assail, that's the plot point. Because otherwise, like, this movie is gloriously stupid in the way that it was intended to be.
I will grant you
it's
there might
not
be one.
Hard sci-fi. You don't have hard sci-fi in which you reference the franchise wars.
The franchise wars is a conflict that I very much see Cargill and I enlisting for when it inevitably comes about.
Yeah, but that's going to be us signing up with Whataburger. We're going to fight for the Whataburger army where you can get a triple meat, triple cheese with bacon, jalapenos, no onions on Texas toast, where you can get anything on Texas toast at any time of the day or fucking night.
I will sever the head of the tyrant Burger King while proudly emblazoned with that W because I fight for the Whataburger Corps.
We are the Whata Army.
What a murder. That's what I'm going to yell as I murder Ronald McDonald. Anyway, what were we talking about?
Stargrove.
So, yeah, that's the thing I really love about this movie is that they really do envision a future where guys like Stallone are completely obsolete, and just watching him fumble around and just be so meat-headed in a culture that is the, like, uber-progressive, past uber-progressive, and yet the one person in this movie who I think is just totally in it to win it is Sandra Bullock.
Yes.
Because she is playing a character who is the one person who still kind of fetishizes the violence of the 21st century, or the 20th century, specifically the 1990s. If you will notice, in her office, she has posters for things like the Red Hot Chili Peppers and Lethal Weapon 3.
Just a quick question.
Yes, Cargo.
Can you look at the laptop and tell us how far into this episode we are?
We are currently 34 minutes into this episode.
We've gotten 34 minutes into the episode and not mentioned or done what you have been waiting for this entire episode. Who produced this movie?
Let me take a quick gander. Oh, that's interesting. It was
me, motherfuckers. Don't you write me a ticket. I will curse all the one. Don't you write me a goddamn ticket. Don't you write me a ticket. This movie's gonna rock.
I can't believe we got almost 35 minutes into this episode before you did your Joel Silver impression. Like, the minute it came up, I was like, oh shit, this is Silverman. He's gonna do the impression again.
Hey, I want Taco Bell. It's 4 a.m. We've been writing this goddamn movie all night. Fred, get me Taco Bell.
In the future, there's only Taco Bell. Fuck everyone else.
Yeah, you know what? You don't get to eat anything but goddamn Taco Bell because of my future, Fred. It's not yours.
By the way, the Fred in this scenario is Fred Decker, who did a lot of kind of uncredited rewrites on this script. And
did Decker do an uncredited rewrite on the script?
He did. And he has a great hello beer.
I love Gwait. That's my favorite Middle Eastern country that we went to war for.
Yes. He has a great quote about this movie where the original script was it started in the future and it was John Spartan being thawed out. And Decker's the one who came in and said, no, we're going to start in the 90s. We're going to see him in the 90s and then we're going to go to the future. And when someone asked him why, he said his exact quote is pretty fucking brilliant. If you don't show Kansas, Oz isn't all that special.
Yeah.
And I was like, holy shit. Like, what a great, like, save the cat just rule to follow in general.
That's a great line. And also the other thing he does is he removes a whole lot of exposition. Like, that's the thing.
There were supposed to be two Bill Cobbs. Now there's only one.
No. I mean, that's this is a very real thing about screenwriting is that you are only given, you know, your average script is going to go between 100 and 120 pages. That's your target. And you only have so many pages with one page equaling 1 minute of screen time on average. You only have so many pages to play around with things. And you need to explain this future and you need to explain the plot. And you need to also do all the things that the audience paid for. So you got to blow shit up. You have to have romantic interest. You have to have some comedy. You have to develop the villain. And you have to explain this fucking world. And if you open up in the world, you have to fucking explain the world constantly. But if you open up in the 90s and show that he is lost in it, it totally explains the things that you have to explain. And it works that way. And structurally, yeah, he's right. Going back in a flashback is not the way to do it. You open this movie up in this dystopian 90s, and then we totally understand why Oz is special.
100% agree.
Let's finish with all the Rip Van Winkle and get moving.
We mentioned the Lethal Weapon 3 poster. Did you happen to notice who plays John Spartan's captain in the 90s? It's the same guy who plays Riggs and Murtaugh's captain in the Lethal Weapon movies.
Oh, yeah.
So it's this a nice movie has Joel Silver tie-in right
That's
there.
One of the other things. We have not gone into, you know, there's a whole host of great character actors in this movie.
Indeed.
You know, I love my favorite character actor in this movie is who the chief of police is in the future.
Oh, yeah, he's the warden from Shawshank.
Yeah, the warden from Shawshank doing something very similar. Like, it's perfect.
The nice guy version of the warden from Shawshank.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, but the thing is that was the thing about the warden from Shawshank is that he's so conservative and he's so, like, uptight. But this version of this character doesn't have that darkness that the warden has. But he's still that kind of prim and proper dude, and he's so good here. He's so, like, you get, like, every time he comes in to be the angry captain and say, no, you're a Neanderthal, fuck this, but without saying fuck this,
because he's not allowed,
he really makes sense. Like, he is terrified. He is so bought into this future, he's terrified of watching this future get torn apart by this fucking, you know, animal.
Yeah.
You know, and the way Sandra Bullock fetishizes the past is very much how people in the 80s and 90s kind of fetishized the 30s and the gangster era. And that's what I see this is like. This is Sandra Bullock's character is a cop who wishes she were a cop on the gangbusters. Like, she wishes she was fucking right there in the Untouchables, fucking killing, you know, gangsters and busting raids and being like, yeah, I know, I like alcohol.
Let's do some good.
But let's go do some good. And so, you know, she wanted to be one of Ness's crew. But she was born in the 80s. She was born in the 70s, and now it's the 90s, and things are kind of boring now, and it's not really exciting. That's kind of what this character is. And she's looking back at things through movies and pop culture. She's not really looking back at it as how it was.
Yeah.
So she doesn't really have her head wrapped around it. Another weird oddity of the time, something that most people don't catch. How does she know martial arts?
She watched Jackie Chan movies.
When was Jackie Chan's first mainstream hit in the United States?
See, this is where you got me. I don't
97.
Know.
It was 96/97. I want to say it's actually 97.
No, that wasn't big enough. Hold on.
It was Rumble in the Bronx was when they first brought him over and, like, gave him a thing. Like, the thing is this is such a Hollywood joke.
Yeah.
At that point.
Well, and it may also be a joke on the fact that Jackie Chan and Jean-Claude Van Damme were the original two people chosen for this movie. I'm sorry. It was... Let me rephrase that. It was Jackie Chan, and I think it was Arnold Schwarzenegger, but Jackie Chan didn't want to play a bad guy. And then it was Steven Seagal and Jean-Claude Van Damme. But Seagal didn't want to play a bad guy, so he said that he would do the movie if they would switch, but Van Damme didn't want to play a bad guy either.
God, oh, God, do I want to live in the alternate universe where he said yes?
Right?
I kind of want to see the 1993 terrible, terrible JCVD versus Steven Seagal movie.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's the thing is, like, I thought one of the only gleaming pieces of corn in the turd that is the Expendables franchise is when Jean-Claude Van Damme played the bad guy in the second one. I thought he was a pretty fucking great villain, and it made me wonder why Van Damme didn't play more villains. I mean, let's be honest, we will always have No Retreat, No Surrender. But why didn't he play more bad guys? He could have been so great at it. That's all I'm saying.
Well, it was because he was JCVD. But here's the thing. This is, again, let's put you in 1993 for a second. In 1993, Seagal versus JCVD was a bigger draw than Stallone versus Snipes.
Yeah.
Like, that was where they went first, and they fell back on Stallone versus Snipes.
This was the backup plan of the movie. I still have not gotten all the way through the plot here. You said it was simple, and yet we've taken 40 minutes and not gotten all the way through it. So Stallone is thawed out in 21st century San Angeles, because apparently this movie takes place in a fucking Grand Theft Auto game where you just make an amalgam of all the cities after
the
great earthquake.
Well, it was the idea of the mega cities. You know, over the past 15 years, we've talked about the idea of Austintonio, where Austin and San Antonio are slowly growing, you know, and we're growing huge. You know, Austin's like the 11th biggest city in the country right now, and it was not anywhere near that 10, 20 years ago. And so this idea that eventually that you'd have the Austin-San Antonio metro area that would be nicknamed Austintonio, because as San Antonio grew north and Austin grew south, they would swallow up all these small towns and would eventually just become one big megacity. And this was an idea that we were very much thinking about in the 90s.
So, by the way, you said megacities. Now, remind me, Cargill, what was the name of the property that took place in the future that had the concept of megacities was a big part of it?
Mike Judge something, Mike or Judge something. Yeah. Judge Dredd,
Judge
maybe?
Judge Dredd. The one, for me, the one big pimple on the ass of this movie that is going to be irritated by all of the three seashells is Rob fucking Schneider.
You know
why is he? I mean, I appreciate that he barely does anything in this movie. That's a real smart move on this Joel Silver's part. But 2 years later, oh God.
Keep in mind that Rob Schneider, apart from being in one of your favorite Jean-Claude Van Damme movies.
Okay, I'm going to refute that. That doesn't even make top 30 Van Dammes for me. Sorry, knockoff. No, thank you.
Rob Schneider was huge at this time. Like, he was just huge. He was a big Saturday Night Live guy. I think at this point he was still on Saturday Night Live. I don't think he had left yet. It may have been one of his last years. But he and Adam Sandler took the fucking reins of Saturday Night Live. And, you know, at this point, Rob Schneider was Brian, the Briarino.
Oh, my God.
Making copies.
Flashing
Brian Salisbury.
Flashing the band. Temporary. Passing Fancy.
Been in a couple of movies. Gonna make the hot chick.
Here and gone.
So, I mean, he was, everybody loved. So having him show up at this time was another, hey, look, it's Rob Schneider. I love Rob Schneider, because we didn't hate Rob Schneider yet. We didn't. As a culture, we still loved Rob Schneider.
That's a fucking soundbite right there. As a junk food cinema. As a culture, we still loved Rob Schneider.
In 1993, we loved Rob Schneider. We did. We had not grown tired of his bit yet, or who he was. Like, it's, you know, it was, you know, everybody loved him. And he's in this movie so very little. Like,
mercifully little.
Like, we mentioned him. We have not mentioned Benjamin Bratt.
Oh, Benjamin Bratt.
Who is so much fun in this movie.
The Curious Case of Benjamin Bratt.
Who is so much fun in this movie. We also, you know, he's in a movie I made. He's a good dude. I like him. He is really great in this movie, though. Like, he is so... I forgot how young he looks in this movie. Like, just look at him, like, he's a baby. Look at him. Like, Sandra Bullock, like, pretty much hasn't fucking aged.
Yeah.
Like, Sandra Bullock, like, sleeps in a glass, you know, tube. She is still every bit as beautiful as she was back in 1993.
Sandy. Yeah, no, I agree.
But he, on the other hand, wow, is he babyface. But he's legitimately fun in this movie.
Yeah, and the thankless job he's doing, and this is where he doesn't get enough credit, he has to portray the wide-eyed rookie cop in an entire police force of naivete.
Yes.
That is really fucking
tough
to pull.
He's the rookie of rookies. Like, it's so crazy. But he does it so well. And when he has his flip where he discovers freedom,
yeah,
and he, like, he goes, like, full native at the end of the fucking movie, is so great. And he's really funny. But the thing, watching the chemistry between him and Sandra Bullock, like, their connections of things in the culture, like, it's like, oh, these two are partners and these two, like, get along. And, like, watching them sing together during the various scenes in the movie are just really fun. And he's having a good time doing it. And also committing to this really stilted language that they all are spitting out.
Armor hot dogs, not the junk food pairing of this particular episode, just in case you were wondering. And then, yes, okay, so... They thaw them out.
Oh, you're going to zig instead of zag? Do I have to spoil it again? No, I'm not going to spoil it.
You're not gonna...
I know what it's going to be, so let's just go.
Oh, you think you know. But so one other person who's in this movie who gets almost no credit, two people in this movie who get almost no credit, one being our second favorite actor turned governor of all time.
Oh, who's barely in the fucking movie.
I mean, it's basically a blink and you miss me because I'm just in the background. I think I should have had a bigger... I mean, if Benny Bratt gets to be front and center, I mean, these biceps should definitely have a few more speaking lines. I mean, that's all I'm saying.
You do realize, I think this year, 2017, we've covered every major movie that he's been in.
We have not covered Abraxas yet.
I said major movie. No, we have not covered Abraxas. Most people are like, what the fuck is Abraxas? Well, yeah, rightfully so.
Is that the chick who's saying Unbreak My Heart? No, that's Tony Braxton. We're talking about Abraxas.
No, we have covered now. We covered all of his other movies this
covered
year.
Predator, Running Man, this one. Oh, my God.
That's his career.
Holy shit.
That is Jesse Ventura's mainstream career. We're done. Bye, Ventura.
What was our boggle? We hadn't covered all of the Jesse Ventura movies yet, and now we have.
By accident.
Signing off, Junk Food Cinema.
What the fuck?
The thing I love about this movie is that, like I said, it does get to play around with being over the top in a way that feels more...
Did you just drop over the top in a fucking Stallone movie?
Meet me halfway.
Across the sky. Again, another movie we covered this year.
Yeah. That's the craziest thing. We've covered all of the Jesse Ventura movies. We've covered like an eighth of the Stallone films.
Yeah.
And he's one of the actors we've covered the most. God damn it. Anyway, I think
one of the things you love most about this movie.
One of the things I love most about this movie is because of the whole idea of that this is a future where violence is abhorrent and everyone's super progressive. It's allowed to be over the top and do a lot of the action movie tropes, and it kind of feels new again because they're making a point about it. So even if it's just Stallone and Snipes doing bad one-liners, there's something that feels very authentic about it because it's like these are obsolete things on purpose.
Yeah, and it's the end of an era.
Yes.
This is the end of that type of filmmaking. This is the end of that type of action movie. That 1 year later, the biggest, most talked about movie of the year would be an independent film starring Bruce Willis and Samuel L. Jackson, Pulp Fiction. This was when Hollywood was really grasping at straws. They didn't know what anyone wanted anymore. They had no idea. We were just, the indie boom was just there. Like the big Sundance had happened a year before this. Those guys were starting to get juice, but Hollywood was still scrambling to try to figure out what people fucking wanted. And this was something they churned out. And it is the end of that era right before it ushers in a new era.
And I didn't even finish my thought from before. The other actor who's, it's the beer's fault. The other actor who's barely in this movie is a young Jack Black as one of the kind of the underground dwellers of Edgar Friendly's army. And Edgar Friendly is a revolutionary who just wants the world to be normal again. And by that, he means a little dirty. They're allowed to, watch porn and drink beer. So he's really just like, he wants to return society to being a frat party. You know, that's all he really wants.
Well, no, he
wants to be Mark Harmon in Summer School.
He is the perfect epitome of what Cobretti wants. He is Cobretti's hero. Yeah. He is the guy who's like, look, America can be whatever it wants to be, but that's the point to America, that I want to be able to do all these things. Will I do all these things? No, but as soon as I get it back, I sure as shit am not going to do it all because fuck this not being able to do it. Because this future literally prevents you from swearing. You know, you get fined money just for saying words that people don't like. You get fined for all sorts of crazy things. You don't have sex. You put on this helmet and think about other people and then have what is actually a really well shot, interesting sequence that
jerked off to it. Wait, what were you talking about? I'm sorry.
It's like porn in the 90s where you would click over to the channel and be all scrambled and like you can actually maybe you saw a nipple in that sequence.
But that was the challenge. Wait, I'm saying way too much. This is mic on. Unplug it immediately.
No more beer for you.
You were saying.
I was saying that was a really well, interestingly shot sequence that I thought was really great. But it is, you know, this future is so restrictive of what we value being American and is so anti-American. And ultimately, it's the theme of this movie is about the fear of becoming a place that is so safe and so nerfed that, yes, it is safe, but it isn't the whole, it misses the whole point of why we're America.
It's so nerfed that when you wreck your car, Nerf literally fills it up to save you. Did you notice that?
That is, yeah.
It actually, it looked more like Floam, Nickelodeon Floam for you kids of the 90s.
I want you to loot, pillage, plunder. I want you to steal. I want you to do all the wonderful things that we used to do before all of this happened. This world will be ours.
I want to tell a quick story that about specifically about this movie.
Tell me a story, Brian.
I will. This is normally your gig on the podcast, but I just want to tell a quick story about... So I was once at a film festival in Montreal. It's the Fantasia Film Festival. Amazing. It's like Fantastic Fest for 3 weeks in Canada. It is fucking awesome. I can't speak any more highly of that film festival. Go if you can. So I'm there, and I'm on my way to the airport from the hotel, and they ask me if I will share the car that's taking me to the airport. I'm like, of course. So the person they bring into the car was the production designer for this movie, Mr. David L. Snyder. And David Snyder, I didn't know who he was. I didn't recognize the name. But he tells me he's a production designer. He's worked on many Hollywood films. And he proceeds to tell me amazing stories for the full 45 minutes it takes to get to the airport. And when we got there, I was like, oh my God, I never want this car ride to end, because some of the things he talked about were mind-blowing. And he told a story about Demolition Man that I have used as my People's Exhibit A in the argument that there was a time when Stallone was power crazy. And I mean, there's a lot of stories that back this up, that at a certain point in his career, Stallone had a lot of pull with studios, a lot of clout, and he used it very irresponsibly. The Demolition Man story goes like this. At the beginning of the movie, when they're walking John Spartan down the hallway, they're, you know, about to put him in the cryo prison, he's being attended by two guards. Apparently, when they went to shoot the movie, the first scene, one of the things that people probably don't know about Sylvester Stallone, he's not what I would call a tall person.
Would you say he's short?
He's short, and he does not care for people to know this. So apparently what happened is the two actors hired to play the guards to walk John Spartan down the hallway at the beginning of this movie, when the title comes up, were both taller than Stallone, and he took one look at them and said, get rid of these guys. And then instead what he did is he lined up all the grips against the wall, and he picked the two grips that were shorter than him, and those guys became the guards for that scene. And David Snyder's telling me this story, and I'm just like, yep, that's Stallone at the height of his douchey power. It's not dissimilar from him firing the lead singer of Journey off of the song for Over the Top, having David Lee Roth come in and sing it, and then singing it with him. This is the Stallone we're talking about. So it was an amazing car ride, and I will never forget that story about Demolition Man. Or the fact that, again, Stallone is mad with power.
Let us also talk about one other crew member of this.
Let us do that.
Normally we don't focus on crew particularly. However, let us talk about the editor.
Oh my God! The wizard! Stallone's wizard of Hollywood, Mr. Stuart Baird.
Who directed three films on his own. Two of them probably movies we will cover eventually.
Stuart Baird.
One of them we will not. Well, yeah, we'll leave Star Trek Nemesis on the vine.
Yeah, sorry, Tom Hardy.
He directed Executive Decision. The man who killed Seagal.
Yeah.
He killed fucking Seagal.
I thought donuts were the ones that killed
And Seagal. U.S. Marshals. But this man, Stuart Baird, a wizard of editing, one of the great Hollywood editors.
I think, in my mind, in Hollywood, he's the Winston Wolfe. He's the guy you call when shit's gotten fucked up and you need someone to come clean it up. Stuart Baird.
Let me run through. I'm going to run through like two dozen names that I'm just going to throw at you.
All right. I'm going to start drinking this beer and I'm not going to stop until you do.
He edited Tommy, Listomania, mm-hmm. The Omen, mm-hmm. Superman, mm-hmm. Outland, mm-hmm. Lady Hawk, mm-hmm. Lethal Weapon, mm-hmm. Lethal Weapon 2. Die Hard 2, Showdown in Little Tokyo, The Last Boy Scout. Yeah, you're out of beer.
Oh, I couldn't do it. It's empty.
You're out of beer. He edited Demolition Man here. Maverick, Executive Decision, which of course he directed. The Legend of Zorro. Superman 2, the Richard Donner cut. Casino Royale.
Wait.
The 2006 Casino
no
Royale.
Shit,
oh, no
shit.
No, he's still cutting
he
great
that.
Shit.
Holy shit.
No, no, no. Vantage Point, which the only thing to talk about in Vantage Point is the editing. one of our films, a film we haven't covered, but we've talked about covering, which we need to, Edge of Darkness.
Oh.
One of the good unsung Mel Gibson movies.
So he's also a big collaborator with Martin Campbell, it sounds
yeah.
like. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, because he also did Salt and Green Lantern. Tried to make sense out of that. Did Skyfall. The crazy, why the fuck did they make this 47 Ronin? And has a movie this year, Bitter Harvest.
Nice.
Like that is his fucking career, guys. I skipped over a couple other stuff like Radio Flyer and stuff that most people don't know. But that is, as any editor who had half that, being Richard Donner's guy, being Martin Campbell's guy, like, having half that filmography would be like, oh my God, this is one of the greats. Stuart Baird is one of the great editors. And man, does he fucking do this movie up. This movie exists as a movie because as wacky and stupid as it gets sometimes, he keeps you in it all the time.
He knows exactly when to cut back to the action. He knows exactly, because a lot of this movie is the fish out of water story of, you know, Stallone being this meathead, the bull in the china shop. But then as soon as you think you're starting to get tired of that bit, here's another fight sequence. Here's Simon Phoenix unthawing all the worst criminals he can imagine, including a reference to Jeffrey Dahmer, who, interestingly, was killed in prison. Like, the way it worked out, by the time this movie was released, he was killed in prison, but that would have been known by the characters, because since the movie starts in 1996,
oh, yeah.
They would have already known that, so Simon Phoenix wouldn't have said, go thaw out Jeffrey Dahmer.
It was a joke that they'd shot before he was killed.
So what they actually, for some of the home releases and some of the TV, they edited it out not because it was offensive, but because it was inaccurate, which I think is funny that they cared about accuracy in Demolition Man.
Yeah.
Like, that was a big deal to them, apparently.
That is the least of the movie's problems.
Let's talk about the scene they should have edited out of this movie, Stuart Baird. Like, I'm going to have to throw you under the bus a little bit here. And not just Cassandra Bullock's in it, but because there's a scene in this movie where Simon Phoenix goes to the Hall of Violence at the museum. Not sure why that would exist, but fine. And he's
in a future in which violence doesn't exist. Having a hall of, like, this is the crazy stuff we used to do to each other. Mm-hmm. Doesn't seem wrong.
Really? Does it seem wrong that all the guns in the display are loaded?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, as long as we can agree on that. Like, fucking cannons have cannonballs in them. I don't understand.
No. I understand why you'd have a cannon and a cannonball. I don't know why you'd actually have working gunpowder there to fire the cannon. That is the part that doesn't make sense to me.
That's my boggle. That's my boggle, Cargill. That's
your
what
boggle.
I'm saying.
And that is a highly accurate boggle. That is one of those scenes. Like, I get why the shotgun works, because we actually see him with a bandolier with shotgun shells in it. So I'm like, okay, yeah, you can fire the shotgun. And then the pulse rifle makes sense because it's got the battery in it. It takes a few minutes to charge up. I don't get the cannon. The cannon does not make any sense to
me. None of us get the cannon. But as he's standing there in the museum and he's looking at kind of a directory, he sees an Asian family walk by. Do you remember this moment?
Oh, yes.
And he immediately goes, oh, it's like, oh, what, whoa. Like, I know this is a bad guy, but holy fuck.
But he's also racist.
He's also racist, and it... I can't prove this. I don't want to cast any aspersions. It kind of feels like an ad lib too. Like, it's just, there's so much that's wrong about this scene.
There really is. Like, but that's, again, that goes back to, I just kind of write that off, not to defend it, but because almost everything that comes out of his mouth doesn't make any fucking goddamn sense.
Yeah.
And he just seems to be chewing up the scenery in a way that is just like, he's a cartoon character who stumbled into a serious world.
Yeah.
Like, he almost feels like a character that belongs more in Last Action Hero than he does in Demolition Man. And I think that this movie's chief flaw, the only problem I think that keeps this movie from being considered a classic alongside stuff like The Terminator or
Die Hard
or Die Hard or, I was specifically thinking of the one I referenced earlier, Total Recall. The thing that keeps it from being something held in that vein is just the fact that Snipes is so all over the map as a character that as a villain, we don't ever take him too seriously. He's just a mess that John Spartan has to mop up. He's not a genuine threat.
I don't know if I agree with that because they do a good, like, I get what you're saying, but I think they do a good enough job of, like the Joker, he's somebody who'll just kill for the hell of it, just for fun. Like, he'll throw somebody through a plate glass window, or he'll you know, electrocute someone just to laugh at it. Like, yes, he's silly, but he's also just, like, super into murder.
He is, although John Spartan, greatest cop of the 1990s. Simon Phoenix, craziest, most dangerous, murderous villain of the 1990s. They're standing 10 feet from each other and can't fucking hit each other because they went to the Imperial Stormtrooper School of Marksmanship.
If I may. Because movie?
Because movie.
Because movie. I feel like this is going to be another catchphrase. Because movie.
Because movie. Yeah, no, but the thing is there are a couple moments in this movie that you have to because movie that...
you have to because movie.
Because, like, literally, those guys, as close as they are to one another, the fact that they're missing each other is embarrassing. The fact that neither of them, through this entire film, get a bullet through the arm or the leg to make it a little more dangerous.
Something, man. Come on.
It really is cartoonish all the way through. Now, the thing is I love the cartoon.
Exactly.
Like, this is a great cartoon, but I feel like Wesley Snipes realizes he's in a cartoon and just fucking goes for it. And just like, I'm going to be the Joker. No one's ever going to let me play the Joker because Nicholson did it. And they're always going to cast white guys as the Joker. So I'm never going to be able to do it. So fuck it. I'm going to play the Joker. And he went all out and did the Joker. That's what I feel this was.
He's still a better Joker than Jared Leto. I want to do something.
You like move on. Like, I'm not going to agree with you.
No,
100%.
I didn't want to stir up the fanboys, you know, like kicking over a rotten piece of fruit. And it's like, oh, where did all these mites come from?
Fuck you, lady.
I want to travel a little bit through time like this movie does and go back to something you said before about his daughter, because you're right. They do mention his daughter
several times.
There's apparently a plot point in this film that was removed about him finding his daughter. Now, when Stuart Baird came in, the movie was much longer, and he did his Winston Wolfe action and cleaned it up. And you know, and one of the things that got lost in that cut was this whole storyline about him finding his daughter in Edgar Friendly's army in the sewers. And there is a scene where he's shown protecting a girl during a shootout in the sewers. That's his daughter. It's never mentioned because that whole storyline was cut out. That's her. She's right there. That is crazy to me.
That's kind of fucked up.
Not to mention, I think she should be considerably older, considering he's been in cryostasis. Because movie.
34 years.
You know what? Because movie.
Because movie.
Because movie. And of course, we have to talk about the kill. We have to talk about the final kill of this movie, which is one of, like there are Bond villains who don't get deaths this good.
Yeah.
The whole fight at the cryo facility. And then, you know, he comes around on that machine and Simon Phoenix's head gets blasted with...
There's an effect that is really dated. Really dated.
I'm trying to think of an excuse. No, there's not.
But I can't. It's a dated effect. And so it's a little weird of an effect to watch. But what happens after that is so good. It is so good.
So good. So good.
In which
so good.
The frozen... fucking Simon Phoenix gets his head knocked off, bounces once, and then shatters.
Yeah. I compare this to Bond specifically because there was a Bond villain who got killed by being frozen by liquid. What's it? Nitrous? Liquid oxygen?
Liquid nitrogen.
Liquid nitrogen. And it's not this good. It's I'm invincible, flash frozen, done. This is frozen, head kicked off, and then smashed. Awesome.
Yeah, it's pretty fucking great.
Oh my gosh. And I also want to mention the fact that you said you opened the show by talking about Dennis Rodman. Dennis Rodman definitely was influenced the haircut by this movie, which is funny because one of the things that Wesley Snipes hated most about this movie was his haircut. He couldn't stand it. And as soon as the movie was over, he shaved his head. And I think that's why Dennis Rodman could just pick up the mantle where he dropped it and run with it. He's the Simon Phoenix of the NBA.
I'm happy that you're happy, but the place where you're supposed to have the toilet paper, you got this little shelf with three seashells on it.
He doesn't know how to use the three seashells. I can see how that could be confusing.
Now, we mentioned a theory that you either had or you had read about.
Oh, I never read it.
The three seashells. Now, the three seashells.
Different theory.
Yeah, different theory. Three seashells are the replacement for toilet paper in this future.
Yes.
Perplexing, to say the least. What's going on with the three seashells, Cargill? Hit me up with some knowledge.
Well, first things first, you take two seashells and you pinch them together between your fingers like a clam.
Uh-huh.
And you use them to pinch off anything that hasn't been pinched off yet. So you pinch it off and you drop it, you know, you end up dropping what you pinch off. And then the third seashell is the one that you use to then go and scrape against the various areas to clean up anything else that's there.
That's horrifying. I'm throwing up on this side of the couch. And that, by the way, is Stallone's explanation.
It is. Okay. So what is filtered down to me is Stallone's explanation.
The steroids have taken a toll adversely on his poor mind. And that was, oh my God. Like, that just makes this whole movie gross. Like, I know there's also the theory that he might be fucking his own daughter because we never see her in this movie. And some people think it's Huxley. But by the way, Huxley in a dystopian future. Come on.
In a Huxley future. I thought that was great. Like, that's exactly what this is. Like, that's the thing is in 1993, they were arguing versus an Orwellian future, arguing for the Huxleyan future.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Fine. But yeah. Anyway, I was trying to find the line. There's the great line that is said right after John Spartan completely freezes and then just smashes the frozen head of Simon Phoenix. And I can't seem to find it.
After, by the way, they have the stare down and the callback to, is it cold in here? Or is it just me?
And he says, good memory.
Good memory.
I like that. Like that's like their Edgar Wright moment where you bookend it. You sow the seed and then you reap. I get it. No, I like that very much. But also, I love this movie. I love the weirdness of it. I love the action sequences. I love the fact that Stallone's getting to do something meta. I love that there's also the whole meta aspect of having Dennis Leary play this revolutionary who stops the movie to do stand-up comedy. You know, I love the fact that we get to see Stuart Baird rescue another movie. I think Fred Decker did some really great work with the script. I think Joel Silver's insane. There's so much to like about Demolition Man that it really, like, it has become one of those movies that whenever I'm having a bad day or whenever I just want to remember why we do this show in the first place, I watch a movie very similar to Demolition Man, and then I watch Demolition Man, and then I watch Demolition Man again.
Your repeated violation of the verbal morality statute has caused me to notify the San Angeles Police Department.
So that brings us to the junk food pairing. Cargill, I will allow you to go ahead and guess what the junk food pairing of this episode is going to be.
I'm going to just go ahead and do it. Just do it.
Pizza Hut.
Yeah.
Yep. Because
of Cobretti.
Because of Cobretti, and because of the fact that I know that most of you are going,
you're
going
to turn into the skit of like, but Taco Bell.
Yeah, because a lot of you are like, wait, Taco Bell's the only restaurant that survived the franchise wars. Clearly, this is the easiest, like, no-brainer junk food pairing of all time.
It really is. I would even zig there and be like, you know, a burrito.
But yes, but here's why I'm going with Pizza Hut. Because one of the oddest things about this movie internationally is that in some countries, they went to the effort to redub and reshoot so that the Taco Bell was replaced by Pizza Hut. Because in certain countries, they don't have Taco Bell. They only have Pizza Hut. So it didn't make sense that Taco Bell was the, like, I'm going to stop and say that again. It didn't make sense to them that Taco Bell was the only restaurant left in the world. It made more sense that that would be Pizza Hut. And to me, that's even funnier than Wesley Snipes' haircut in this movie. So, I mean, what do you think? What do you think, Cargill?
Yeah, that'll work. And the fact that this is Marion Cobretti's fever dream, and Marion Cobretti famously cuts a slice of pizza in half with a scissors.
Yeah.
Because, fuck yeah, why wouldn't you?
We didn't even talk about, by the way, we didn't even talk about Associate Bob in this movie. Associate Bob, who is played by Glenn Shaddix, better known as Otho from Beetlejuice, who is this, like, weird Lord Varys eunuch type character.
Who that's what he is. He's Vanilla Ice Varys.
Vanilla Varys. The junk food pairing this week is Vanilla Varys.
Varys Ice. There it is. Varys. We just workshopped it.
The junk food pairing is Varys Ice. Go out and have yourself a tall glass of Varys Ice. Because this movie goes, and our movie goes, and this movie goes, and our movie goes. Thank you so much for joining us on this this episode of Junk Food Cinema. I'm so excited that I got to talk about Demolition Man. It's been a long time coming, and I'm so glad that we finally got to talk about it.
And that we had two movies in a row that end with Sting songs.
Oh my God, we haven't talked about that. How did we almost get to this episode and not talk about that?
I think
that?
We briefly mentioned it earlier.
That this whole movie is based on a Police song called Demolition Man, and I'm verifying this right now, but one of the things we talked about when we did our Three Musketeers episode...
When we did that episode All for Love...
And one for all, or two for all, if you want to make this a couplet, in fact. It's based on a song by the Police called Demolition Man. And for this movie, Sting himself, has the song Demolition Man on the soundtrack. He also has a song called King of Pain, Shape of My Heart. Almost the whole fucking, in fact, the whole soundtrack that you can buy on Amazon is all Sting. All of it is Sting. You get one restaurant, you get one, and there's only going to be one singer, and it's fucking Sting. And fuck you if you don't like Sting. Don't you give me a ticket. You put that ticket back. Cargo, where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me on Instagram and Twitter at Massawyrm, MASSAWYRM. And you can still find my book, Sea of Rust, wherever you buy books, audiobook, ebook, physical book. You can buy a book.
Hey, guys, you can buy a book, just so you know. And you can find me on, I don't think I said this last week, you can find me online at BryGuySalisbury on Twitter. You can follow this show at Junk Food Cinema. You can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And of course, if you really like the show, you can go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema and pledge $1 an episode. And just for that little amount of money, $4 a month, you get access to bonus content that only you get to hear. And that keeps the lights on here at Junk Food Cinema. And I can't tell you how much we appreciate that. That's what allows us to keep recording, to watch these movies, to potentially, you know, do these live shows that we're hoping to do more of in the future. So please continue to support us. We really appreciate it. But for now, Simon Says, end the episode.
You are fined 1 credit for a violation of the verbal morality statute.